when Colorado became a territory in 1866, the executions became more legally justified. In 1859, there were basically sophisticated lynchings.
Well, over the 150-odd years of the death penalty in Colorado, there's been ups, there's been downs, there has been efforts to repeal it at the state legislature. Right now, there are three people on death row, all African-American, all men, and they're all from the same high school. They all went to Aurora High School, which I just found interesting and kind of disturbing. But tell us about the three people who are on, and when I say death row, there isn't death row per se, but they are all... They have all been sentenced to death.
Yes, there sort of is a death row. They're all in a special area, high confinement area, in Colorado State Prison down in Canyon City. So it's not a death row in the sense of, you know, a huge tier only for men sentenced to death, but it is a close confinement quarters down in Canyon City.
Well, we'll go through those three cases because they're all very relevant to the current conversation now. Sir Mario Owens, Robert Ray, and Nathan Dunlap.
Well, as you mentioned, they're all African Americans from the same high school in Aurora. And right now in Colorado, there's really one prosecutor who's gung-ho on the death penalty, and he's from Arapahoe County. So we have huge regional variations in the imposition of the death penalty. Dunlap has been on death row since 1992. Only after he was sentenced to death, when he began to get proper health care, was it discovered how mentally disturbed he was. With the medications now in the prison, he's doing quite well. But he was convicted of killing four people in a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant in Aurora. He's had a perfect disciplinary record while in prison for, 1992? That's 25 years. And was almost executed back in 2013 until Governor Hickenlooper announced that as long as he is in office, there will be no executions. We have basically a temporary moratorium on the death penalty. The other two men on death row, Robert Ray and Sir Mario Owens, were convicted of a double homicide. They killed, it was actually a witness elimination, but they were convicted of killing a young couple who had just graduated from college. It really just tears your heart out. But this was also in Arapahoe County. And that crime would have been in, 2002 or 2003. So they were sentenced to death in 2007 and 2009. And their cases haven't even reached the appellate court yet. It's still being litigated in trial court. So the amount of money being spent on those two cases is just astronomical. Both of them have teams of lawyers who meet regularly and who are just spending money by the bucketful trying to get the case ready so that it can go on to an appellate court.
As we mentioned, all three African-American men, the only three people on Colorado's so-called death row right now, are all from Aurora, all went to Aurora High. There was another very high-profile death penalty case in Aurora over the Aurora Theater shooting that the prosecutor was seeking the death penalty, but the jury didn't go with the death penalty, so he has been sentenced to life without parole. How significant was that particular case in the overall conversation around the death penalty here in Colorado?
There are actually two cases, and the other case doesn't get as much publicity. James Holmes, of course, was one, the Aurora movie theater with 12 deceased victims, plus many, many others who were injured. But the other was a man named Dexter Lewis, who went into a bar in South Denver and killed five people. That case, too, they sought death. They did not get it, largely because of Mr. Lewis's long history of child abuse, not only from the day he was born, but 9 months before he was born. His father tried to give his mother an abortion by beating her up. When Dexter was born, he basically was unloved from day one. His father was the founder of the Crips gang in Denver, and Dexter was exposed to all sorts of violence at a very, very early age. And once the jury heard about that history, then they turned him, instead of a monster that we don't understand, they turned him, the jury learned to see him as a human being just like any of the rest of us. And many of us, had we been brought up in those same circumstances, would have committed crimes of criminal criminal violence like that. So in both those cases, the more people learn about the death penalty, the more likely they are to oppose it. And that's probably true of the general public as well.
Well, in terms of the opposition to the death penalty, Colorado, over the 150-odd years that it's had the death penalty, there have been times where it's been repealed, then it's been reinstated, repealed, reinstated, and efforts at the state legislature. Now, in 2009, there was a very close call, I suppose, on legislation to repeal it. What happened then, and why did it not succeed?
Well, one of the problems that Colorado has is we've got a huge number of cases, of homicide cases that aren't solved. 35-40% of all murders that take place in Colorado end up as cold cases. They go on and on and on, and it really re-victimizes the family of the victim. Their number one concern is not really what happens to the guy. It's knowing that the guy is captured and tried and knowing what happened to their loved one in the last hours of her or his life. So there's a group in Colorado called Families of Homicide Victims and Missing Persons that coincidentally my students have been working on for 15 years, documenting unsolved homicides here in Colorado. And they've now documented about 1,600 of these cases. And there's a website that people can go to, and they have annual meetings where the families of these homicide victims come together. And there have been efforts to establish a statewide cold case squad going back to 2006, 2007. And the legislature kept saying, well, we'd like to, but we don't have the money. And then out of the other sides of their mouths, they were saying, well, we need the death penalty for families of homicide victims. So the families of the homicide victims came forward and said, get rid of the death penalty. Let's use the money that we're spending on all these death penalty appeals and instead use it to have cold case squads that can investigate the murders of our loved ones. As a matter of fact, the hearings on that bill in Denver in 2009 attracted so many family members of homicide victims, many of whom were holding 8x10 pictures of their deceased loved ones, that they had to move it into the chambers of the old Supreme Court. A very, very powerful testimony, but in the end, the bill failed by one vote, and it's not clear whether or not Governor Ritter would have signed it, but it was a huge outpouring of those families of homicide victims. Now, many of those families probably were pro-death penalty, if they could get their mitts on the person who killed their loved one. But they realized after reflection that the money is better spent on, if we're going to help families of homicide victims, it's not only the, you know, the 1% who win the lottery by having a death sentence for the killer of their loved one. We have to think about the 99% of the cases that are lost, that police officers forget about, that really aren't being investigated. And so thinking of the homicide victims, the families as a whole, they would much rather have their money spent on solving the cases rather than taking a guy who already will die in prison. If you're convicted of a capital offense, the only other possible sentence is life imprisonment without parole. So we already know the guy is going to die in prison. And they just said, that's enough. You know, let's just use the extra money and solve more of these cases.
It would seem that having the families of murder victims and people, the families of people whose cases are yet to be solved, speaking out, I mean, it's such a compelling argument. What were the political arguments made against it, and was it very much along partisan lines?
It wasn't. One of the top pro-death penalty voices here in Colorado is a former state representative and now state senator named Rhonda Fields. And she's African-American. And it was her son and his fiance who were murdered by Ray and Owens. So two of the three people on death row were convicted of killing the son and fiance of a state legislator. And she is very, very solidly pro-death penalty. Though, personally, she said some things here and there that make me think, after she's been through this ride now for 10 years, that she's having second thoughts about it, that she's wondering whether or not the death penalty really does help cure those wounds. And so we'll see in the upcoming legislative session what she ends up doing. If she came out opposing the death penalty, that would be a very, very strong voice.
Well, on Wednesday, February 15th, there could be another piece of legislation introduced at the State House here in Colorado around repealing the death penalty. Who is behind that measure, and how is that a little bit different?
It's been introduced by Senator Lucia Guzman, and she too is a family of a homicide victim. family member. And but she, for a long, long time, many years, has been involved in anti-death penalty actions. So she has introduced a bill to abolish the death penalty, and there'll be very interesting hearings on it Wednesday, February 15th in Denver. So we'll see how that goes.
We're speaking with Professor Michael Radlett this morning here on KGNU, and he is a noted death penalty scholar, and his latest book is The History of the Death Penalty in Colorado, going back all the way to 1859 and up, as we're hearing, to present day, because it's a kind of a living history, I suppose, in many ways. He's our guest this morning here at KGNU. In all the states is executed, I think, 101 people in the
103.
103 mm-hmm. people, all male.
Yes.
And all for the crime of murder.
Yes.
Okay. And there has been, as I said, a kind of a repeal and being reinstated over the course of, you know, the 150 years that we're looking at. The last reinstatement was 1978. That was the Supreme Court reinstated it then. What were some of the movements and some of the context behind the repeal efforts in the past?
The biggest repeal was by the legislature in 1897. And they just totally got rid of it for everything. A lot of religious opposition. People realized the death penalty was not a deterrent. And people, you know, in those days, Colorado was trying to look sophisticated, to be the most developed state between Chicago and San Francisco. And the idea of the Wild West hanging didn't go with that image. So they abolished it. But then what happened was there were four lynchings, one of which attracted tremendous national publicity. There was a African-American kid who committed a crime in Lyman, came to Denver. He confessed to it. I suppose he committed the crime, that he never had a trial. The sheriff announced that he'd be on the 1 o'clock train back to Lyman the following Saturday, and where he was met by a crowd of 500 people. And they grabbed him, brought him to the farmhouse of the family of the victim, and literally burned him at the stake. They tied him to a railroad rail, and in front of several hundred people, poured gasoline on him and burned him. And the next morning, they got it in the New York Times. And the legislators and merchants didn't like that because it made Colorado look horrible. So the death penalty was brought back in 1903, not as a deterrent to homicide. If you go back and look at the newspaper reports, nobody talked about that. Everybody talked about it as being a deterrent to lynching, which, of course, today is ridiculous. We have 19 states that don't have the death penalty, and those states don't resort to lynching, but that's why Colorado has the death penalty.
What are your thoughts on the dynamics and the groups and the movements that are either in support of the death penalty historically and now in the state, and the ones who are opposed? I mean, say, for example, where's the Catholic Church or other churches who are very vocal when it comes to abolishing abortion, and they label themselves as pro-life? Where are they when it comes to the death penalty, and have they had any kind of influence?
Well, the Catholic Church is now firmly opposed to the death penalty. A decade ago, there was a little asterisk. They said only for the worst of the worst. But I think then they realized that whatever the worst of the worst is, in practice, it wasn't being implemented effectively. Now Pope Francis is really out front on the worldwide effort to abolish the death penalty. And the bishops in Colorado and priests are generally behind that call. How far behind is a little bit debatable. Some of the top pro-death penalty voices in Colorado are themselves Catholic. Former Attorney General John Salazar is Catholic. Bill Ritter, former governor, is Catholic. And most importantly, George Brockler, state attorney from Arapahoe County, and by any measure, the most vocal pro-death penalty voice in the state of Colorado. What's happened today is the death penalty in Colorado has virtually nothing to do with crime control. It has everything to do with politics. And George Brockler is rumored to be a gubernatorial candidate in 2020, I guess, is our next election. And a great way to get your name in the newspaper is to seek the death penalty. George Brockler won on the Holmes case because his name was in every newspaper in the state regularly, even though he lost the case. He did another death penalty case, an unbelievable case of a guy named Edward Montour, who killed a prison guard in Lyman. Montour at first refused to see attorneys, pleaded guilty, asked for the death penalty. He was sentenced to death. And then that conviction got thrown out. The defense immediately went to Brockler and asked for life imprisonment without parole in exchange for a guilty plea. Brockler said no. The victim in the case's father, Bob Audubon, also a prison guard, became very, very opposed to the death penalty. And when they lined up the jurors, potential jurors, for a retrial in that case, Mr. Audubon showed up with a picture of his son walking back and forth along the line of prospective jurors, saying, "Please don't kill the man who killed my son." Very powerful voice. Nonetheless, Brockler stood opposed to that. All those preparations for the trial went on for a couple years. Millions of dollars were spent. And in the end, on the second day of the trial, Brockler called the defense, made an offer, the same offer that the defense had been arguing for several years, and Montour was immediately sentenced to death. So, you know, they say there's three reasons for the death penalty. Number one is politics, number two is politics, and number three is politics. It's just a great way for prosecutors to get their name in the paper. And, you know, despite Catholicism, despite the wishes of the families of the victims, he'll go ahead with that.
Now, you mentioned some pro-death penalty names like Governor Ritter, Salazar, Democrats as well. And so we often think of, you know, this as being a partisan issue, Republicans very much in favor, Democrats against, but that's not been the case really in the state.
But even this year, for the bill that Senator Guzman is sponsoring, there are all sorts of Republicans in the state legislature, and not a single one of them have come forward supporting the abolition bill. So it's really kind of depressing. To whatever degree religion is supposed to affect morality, it doesn't seem to be. The Catholic delegation in Denver hasn't gotten the memo.
Who was Joe Arride?
Joe Arride, it's pronounced. And we only know that because a couple years ago we found a great nephew who was able to tell us how to pronounce it. Joe Arride was executed in Colorado in 1939, and he was developmentally disabled, had walked away from a state training school in Grand Junction, hopped on a freight car and went to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And Joe's home was Pueblo. And there had just been a brutal murder in Pueblo of a little girl named Dorothy Drain. And the sheriff in Cheyenne said, "Oh, you're from Pueblo. Oh, do you know anything about this?" And one of the characteristics of people who are developmentally disabled is they very much like to get along with people, and it's very easy to get the people to agree to anything they say. So this sheriff in Cheyenne, without recording the conversations or doing anything that today we would consider regular police procedure, called the sheriff in Pueblo and said, "Look, I got your guy. I got a guy here who just confessed to that murder." This surprised the sheriff in Pueblo because they already had arrested somebody who'd also confessed, who had the murder weapon, and the evidence against him was incredibly strong. His name was Frank Aguilar, executed in 1939. Then somebody had written a poem about the case without specifying the name of the inmate, and that was read in about 1990 by a Colorado native named Robert Persky. Persky lived in Connecticut and had spent his life working with developmentally disabled people and was very curious about what this case was all about. So he was able to contact death penalty historians who tracked it to Joe Arride. And Persky then came out to Colorado and he wrote a marvelous book called Deadly Innocence that was published, maybe 2002, which tells the story of that case. And then the Colorado Springs ARC chapter, it used to be called the Association of Retarded Citizens, but the group that supports developmentally disabled, basically adopted Joe, and they did more investigation on the case. A lawyer stepped forward, wrote a clemency memo. The group also purchased a granite grave marker for Joe. He's buried in a prison cemetery in Canyon City. Beautiful marker. That was unveiled in 2007. In any event, they presented all this evidence to Governor Ritter, himself the former DA in Denver. His background is law enforcement. And Governor Ritter, who is Catholic, was so impressed by that case that in the last days that he was in office, he granted a complete posthumous pardon. Joe's tombstone was then changed to give not only the date of death, but also the date of the pardon. So if one goes down to the cemetery, it's Greenwood Cemetery in Canyon City, next to Joe's gravestone is the proclamation that Governor Ritter signed giving a complete posthumous pardon. That doesn't happen very often. It was just stunning. And really, Governor Ritter, you hate to call an act that, just doing the right thing, you hate to call it brave. He sure did the right thing, and I would say he was brave to do it. It's a real feather in his cap. I hope when he meets St. Peter, that the first thing that St. Peter says is to pat him on the head for doing that act.
Cases like Uribe, who were, pardoned afterwards, are obviously innocent at the time. I mean, developmentally disabled, coerced into making a confession. Those type of cases are often put forward by death penalty abolitionists, saying there's such a high likelihood of executing somebody who is innocent. Just look at all the people who've been exonerated from death row. And yet I've also spoken to death penalty abolitionists who say that should not be the argument. We should say, even if there's no doubt about a person's guilt, that's when we need to say we still don't want to execute this person. I mean, what are your thoughts those arguments?
Yeah, it's an interesting argument. I taught a class one time in London, and I had a number of very affluent American students in the class. And one day we had a representative of Amnesty International who came in with pictures of people being tortured and other ways mistreated in prisons. And he was talking about the death penalty. And I'll never forget this. One woman came up after class chewing her gum and said, "Well, I never really thought about it, but I guess I'm against the death penalty unless they deserve it." You know, it's sort of like if we get the worst of the worst, then those folks deserve it. And right now we don't talk about who deserves to get tortured. It's just totally off the books. I was in London last week, and the attitude there of people talking about the death penalty, we may as well be talking about putting people in the rack. It's so medieval. It's so off the table in England and all of Western Europe, all of Latin America for that reason too, that the U.S. is just truly an outlier on this issue.
What do you think is going to change that?
Well,
dynamic?
It is changing.
In 1976,
there were 16 countries around the world that had abolished the death penalty. Today, there's 140. The first weekend of February 2017, the president of Sri Lanka cleared death row. 100 people were removed from death row and sentenced to long prison sentences. So in every year, there's two or three countries that come forward and abolish the death penalty. Even in the United States, who would have thought? In the last 8 years, there have been 7 states that have abolished the death penalty. Last year, even Nebraska abolished the death penalty. Nebraska's as red as it gets, but they abolished it. The governor came back. The governor loves the death penalty, wanted the publicity, so he vetoed that legislation. And then the legislature came back and overrode the veto. And the governor was still ticked off. His family is quite affluent. They own the Chicago Cubs, and his old man runs some stock broker, TG Ameritrade or something like that. Anyhow, they got buco bucks, and they poured that into the referendum. And sure enough, in November of 2016, in a citizens' referendum, they reinstituted the death penalty. Now the governor in Washington, there's a serious move there to abolish the death penalty this year. Montana is on the books. But in recent years, states like Connecticut, Maryland, Illinois, all the new states, New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, they've all abolished the death penalty. No state has reintroduced the death penalty now in 20 years. So the momentum now, slow though it may be, worldwide, is towards total abolition of the death penalty.
And what about the future here in Colorado, given that Hickenlooper has put that stay of execution on at least one of the death row inmates, one of the three here in the state, and so that's not going to happen while he is the governor. there is a gubernatorial race, and one of the very likely candidates is that district attorney from Aurora, George Brockler, who is very gung-ho and has really led the way in trying to prosecute death penalty cases.
Exactly. So in the next, before that next gubernatorial election, which I guess is 2018, before I said 2018, we expect to see more death penalty prosecutions, not only in Arapahoe County, but elsewhere, if Mr. Brockler can get his buddies to go for death in certain cases. Already, there's another case, the only other case in Colorado where they're actively seeking the death penalty, a murder of a prison guard down near Pueblo. And there, the prison guard, the victim's family is also opposed to the death penalty. So in any event, the death penalty is not going to go away until we get rid of it legislatively. Up until last year, that was a little bit dangerous because by petition, it could get on the ballot quite easily. And now we've changed that, so it's more difficult to have a ballot initiative. But what we need now to really put another nail in the executioner's coffin is for Governor Hickenlooper to commute all three death sentences of the people on death row. And if we did that, then if anybody is sentenced to death today, it'll be 25 years before they're executed. It's just, we get an opportunity to start brand new and to do a fair and full assessment about whether or not the death penalty is worth all the fuss.
And the money. Do you think the money and the cost argument, because it's incredibly expensive to prosecute a death penalty case, to have somebody on death row and then ultimately to execute them. Do you think that could be one of the arguments in the death penalty abolitionists' toolbook?
Yes, and it has been in some of the states that have abolished it. Here in Colorado, Mr. Brockler argues that it doesn't cost him any money at all to seek the death penalty, that the James Holmes case was basically free because everybody who worked on the case was already on his payroll. And it's an incredibly deceptive argument filled with alternative facts, if you will, because every study that's ever been done on the death penalty, whether it's done by legislators, the state Supreme Court, by journalists, or by scholars, has come to the conclusion that the death penalty costs many, many times more than life imprisonment without parole. And now we're looking at least $6 or $8 million per case. James Holmes was several times more than that because of the expenses of mental health. So if we're what are we supposed to be doing with that money? Is it supposed to, if we want to cut crime rates, that's a good goal. Maybe we should hire more cops. If we want to help families of homicide victims, that's a good goal. And we need to do more to help those families. Why don't we try to solve some of those unsolved homicides? So the goals are something that we all share, but the death penalty is basically flushing the money down the toilet. And why it goes on, I don't know.
Well, death penalty scholar Michael Radlett is a professor of sociology at CU, and his latest book is The History of the Death Penalty in Colorado. All the more pertinent as we look at the current reality of the death penalty and potentially the future with the upcoming gubernatorial race. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.